Six music.
Discover more mixes from Six, from some of our favourite and most exciting artists on the BBC Sounds app.
BBC Radio.
BBC Radio 6
Music.
Right now, it's Matt Everett's The First Time with Holly Johnson.
Hello, I'm Matt Everett, and you're listening to a brand new series of The First Time here on BBC Six Music and BBC Sounds. This is the show where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and take a look at their first pivotal musical moments that made them who they are today. Today's guest was the frontman and songwriter with a band whose music, lyrics, attitude, style, videos, and sheer charisma dominated much of the 1980s. During their seven-year career, they had a run of colossally ambitious and record-breaking singles that included Relax, Two Tribes, and The Power of Love. These were sometimes controversial, often provocative, but always, always brilliant. There has never been a group like Frankie Goes to Hollywood, and there never will be. But our guest's own musical story began before then and continues to the present day. So I'm very pleased to welcome to the first time my guest, Holly Johnson. In this show, we talk about Holly's youth as a Bowie and Boland-obsessed teen in Liverpool and some of the aggression that he had to deal with until he found like-minded, extravagantly artistic souls, many of whom became the foundation of Liverpool's widely eclectic and eccentric post-punk scene that included Deaf School, Echo and the Bunnymen, Teardrop Explodes, and Big in Japan, with whom Holly played. We also cover the formation of Frankie Goes to Hollywood, their first gigs, and of course, the huge success of Relax and their first album, Welcome to the Pleasure Dome. And Holly also talks about how the 80s media dealt with a band who included two openly gay singers. Frankie were unapologetic and celebratory when it came to their sexuality. He also covers the pressure that accompanied Frankie's success and messy breakup. We also talk about Holly's successful solo career and collaborations, and of course, some of the music that's meant the most to him. And not long after their unexpected reunion to perform a song when Eurovision came to Liverpool, and on the eve of the 40th anniversary of Welcome to the Pleasure Dome, I asked Holly if a full Frankie Goes to Hollywood reunion is a possibility. But I started by asking Holly, as I do with all my guests, when was the first time he was aware of music?
There was a portable record player in the house in Liverpool, and my sister had records, my brother had records, my dad had records. And I would play all these records and try and learn the lyrics and sing along. And it would be anything from James Brown's Sex Machine, Sitting on the Dock of the Bay by Otis Redding. My dad liked Johnny Cash, so there were country and western records.
Patsy Cline as well, is that
right?
Oh,
yes, yeah, Patsy Cline, absolutely. And really, Hollywood musicals is another thing that you would go and see either on the pictures or you'd see on the TV. Judy Garland, people like that, you know, were all part of my childhood landscape of music. You know, hearing David Bowie's Space Oddity on the radio for the first time after I'd seen the film 2001 Space Odyssey. That was weird.
Didn't you, like, choir master
took
you to go and see
it was the choir outing which took us to see that film, and obviously it was mind-blowing as a child of 8 or 9, and he was bemused by it as well as us, because it's a very bizarre film.
It's great, but
a visual spectacular, but not much clue to what's going on, especially for kids of that age. Before that, Ride a White Swan by T-Rex.
Yes, why did you love T-Rex so much?
Maybe it was Mark Bolan's androgyny, his curly hair, and I had curly hair, and the glitter on his face that he wore on Top of the Pops. There was something new and exciting about him.
Riding on out like a bird in the sky, was riding on out like you were a bird. Flying on out like an eagle in a sunbeam, riding on out like you were a bird. In the old days, wear a tall hat and a tattered gown. Ride a white swan that the people of a Belgian. Wear your hair long, baby, can't go wrong.
Then my sister gave me Electric Warrior. I was 10 or 11, and it was the first album that really spoke to me as a teenager and why I wanted an acoustic guitar and learn to play and write songs. That was definitely a big trigger in my life, that record, with its amazing cover of Mark Bolan in a golden aura on
cover,
black.
Yeah.
You know, and the illustrations inside and the lyric sheets, and it was the whole universe that was far away from where I lived in Liverpool, which was kind of a black and white world, black and white television, black and white Beatles wallpaper in my sister's room. And, you know, Sgt. Pepper did turn the world to Technicolor somewhat, but Mark Bolan was something else, this glamorous elfin magical creature, yeah. Almost.
He was.
And then, of course, David Bowie.
Well, this is it. You've said in the past that it wasn't just Bowie and his music. It was Bowie and Angie Bowie. It was like the pair of them represented something that was so appealing, so sort of magical again.
Yes, glamorous, yeah. In actual fact.
They look great, man.
They did, Angie. And I do believe to this day Angie had such a huge influence on Ziggy Stardust. And basically, without her American pushiness, mm-hmm. and bravura and bravado, or whatever the correct word is, I don't think he would have made it as a pop star. I think she facilitated the whole thing and gets very little credit for it.
I think you're right.
But I think that happened to women of the era generally. Like June Bolan, who managed Mark Bolan, was pretty instrumental in that world. But women were really mentioned in the history books of pop and rock music, strangely.
Yeah, yeah. So what were you like when you were like that age that music starts to become an obsession, like 15, 16? What kind of... Because you've talked about being quite shy at school.
It's shy but flamboyant.
Well, this is it. This is one of the classic sort of performer-artist dualities. It's like, don't look at me. No, but look at me. Please look at me. No, don't look at me. Is that where you found yourself at that age then?
Well, yes. There was mascara on going to school and Ziggy Stardust red hair.
Yeah.
And it didn't go down well in this all-boys school in the city centre, the Liverpool Collegiate Grammar School for Boys. And me and my friend Peter, who was a dead ringer for David Bowie with blonde hair, tall and thin, and we were tortured daily for being queer, you know, which we obviously were, but couldn't do anything about our queerness.
But you kept on going in glammed up, though. That's a steely determination.
Well,
that's quite...
we did for a while, but the kicking and the spitting and the constant taunts got to us, and we started to play truant.
Right.
A lot. And going into town, the school was near the city centre and to St. John's Precinct, where we were obsessed with a young Jane Casey who wore a silver boiler suit and shaved her hair and painted it silver. And she was sat in the reception of a unisex hairdresser called A Cut Above the Rest. Pete Burns was the Saturday boy and Lynn Burns was the colourist. And we met these people and realised this is our tribe.
We have found out we are home.
We're only 14 and 15 and they're a bit older than us, but we are one of these people. So we found out where they went at night and we started going to the Lisbon, a gay bar.
What was that like? So a first big formative kind of place to hang out then. What was it like?
Well, it was just a hairdressing salon, and we didn't actually hang out in the salon. We just walked past and looked in, and Jane came out and to tell us how amazing we looked, and, you know, Pete Benz liked my hair, and that was like, wow, you know. But he was only about 16, I think. I was like 15 or 14, and he wasn't much older than me at all. So these colourful creatures were very inspirational. Music was sort of attached with fashion in that era. Right. There was Roxy Music, of course, which were the second band I ever saw live. David Bowie was the first concert I went to at the Empire Theatre. We sagged school. That's the word for playing truant in Liverpool. We sagged school just to get the tickets in the morning, me and my friend Peter. And, you know, we had to be there.
I'm an alligator. I'm a mama, papa coming for you. I'm a space invader. I'll be a rock and rolling bitch for you. Keep your mouth shut.
A lot of other, like, future artists would be at that show. Like, Mark Allman came in from Southport, and although we didn't know then. And, you know, Pete Burns was there, of course, and all the other characters from A Cut Above the Rest. Being an apprentice hairdresser at that time was quite fashionable. It was the advent of crazy colour, you could have bizarre streaks in your hair, and it was a thing.
Yeah. When was your first performance? When did you first, not in church, but like to an audience in some
form? To an audience. Yeah. I performed Jacques Brel's My Death on an acoustic guitar in support of a punk band called the Spitfire Boys that Paul Rutherford was actually a member of.
My Death, that's a big song.
Oh, God. A lot bigger than, you know, and it's strange for a teenager to perform. But it went down quite well, actually, because it was quite non-punk in a sense, although very punk in another. I think they booked this punk band so they could spit at them and throw beer at them. But I seem to have gone down quite well.
Because you said this lovely thing about the arrival of punk, saying, like, because it was kind of asexual in that, like, oh, you're straight, you're gay, it doesn't matter, we're just punk now. And it became this wonderful sort of overarching mindset. And I guess that must have been a pretty good thing to experience, having been, you know, bullied and felt separate, to being like, oh no, this is, we're punk now.
Yeah, well, for one day, if you wore makeup, you were a queer. The next day, you were a punk.
Exactly.
And that's what you got shouted, or as they punched your face in, that's what they would call you.
Was it really like that?
Oh yeah. You know, I would get random punches aimed at me for no reason, just for walking down the street. Liverpool was, you know, quite a violent city in those days. And at that time, I lived with my mum and dad near Penny Lane. I mean, my mum went to school with George Harrison and knew John Lennon's mum. The Beatles were a very real thing because people you knew had connections with them in some way. My Auntie Kath applied for her passport at the same time as the Beatles and was in the waiting room with them getting their passport, and people would talk about them as if they were real people, and it gave you a sense that you could do something in music, that it was a real thing that you could do. But of course, punk had the extra element of you could do this without actually being able to play an instrument as well. So all of that was very liberating. It was a kind of rebelling against the establishment of the music industry in the 70s.
Yeah.
So it was a great thing. And it all centered around the nightclub Eric's, for me, a music venue. But this scene around Liverpool with the Eric's Club sort of sprung out of nowhere in about 1976. And the Sex Pistols played there. And it was just the place to be and go and get involved. And I got asked to join a band called Big in Japan when I was 16 to play bass guitar. And I'd never played bass guitar. I could play, you know, chords on an acoustic guitar. And I just said, OK, I'll do it. And it was Bill Drummond who asked me to join the group with Ian Brody. Bill was 10 years older than me, but Ian was about 18 months older than me, but a very talented guitarist even then. He had a sense of what an arrangement was. We'd never really thought much about arrangement in pop songs or music songs, and Ian was very aware. And then Budgie joined, who later on went to be in the Banshees. And, of course, Jane Casey was the lead singer and looked amazing. By then, her look had developed. So from a cut above the rest, she became a sort of new wave punk icon.
Yeah,
you know, she eventually was on the cover of The Enemy as part of Pink Military, Pink Industry, those two bands that she fronted.
Yeah.
She was my flatmate for a while, and Eric's was just the centre of it all, where you'd get Blondie performing.
You saw Talking Heads there, didn't you?
I saw Talking Heads. I saw the Human League. I saw a proto New Order there. You know, the Cramps would play there. The Police even played there early on. And The Clash and all kinds of bands. Big in Japan were like the house band. We rehearsed in the club in the daytime every day, which I found a bit much. But, you know, it was quite a tight band for a while. And then we got a John Peel session. And when we split up, we got another one. And lots of things went on that were real.
I was watching a film of Yankee Rose, well, like your first release it would have been.
It was my first single on the Eric's label.
What's interesting is your voice is kind of there already. That tone, that delivery. I mean, obviously your voice, it got stronger and more developed as it went on. But you can hear it's you. Even early on, it's distinctly your voice, isn't
it? Well, I had been practising in my mum's front room for years, trying to sing Bowie songs like Quicksand or T-Rex songs, but finding them a bit difficult, the chords. Yeah. And so I would write my own simpler chords and songs. This was in conjunction with my friend Peter, who also had a guitar, and we would learn chords together and play records and dance to them in his mum's front room. And that relationship of musical appreciation was really important, having a friend who also, you know, liked what you liked. It was great.
Words defy the tune. Whip cracking moon. The spell is in the irons and the spurs on your boots. Yankee Rose, a gun that shoots. Ranches on the plain ran me with your name. The spell is in the dirt, the pistol smokes. Yankee Road.
Hugh Stevens on Six Music.
I was in the car and my six-year-old opened the window and he says, I want everybody to hear this song. That's when I realised that's sort of what the show is, that I play music that I want everyone to hear and that we're all listening at the same time to great new music and all the classic songs that we all listen to together. It's about the whole culture, from the record shop to the gig venue, celebrating live music in all its forms, talking to the legendary and emerging musicians. All live from my home city of Cardiff. Escape the day and start your evening with me.
Hugh Stevens.
Tuesday to Friday afternoon from 4.
On Six Music.
Six Music.
It's Matt Everett's The First Time with Holly Johnson.
Six Music.
Tell me about the first Frankie rehearsal.
It was in the same place as the previous band I'd been in's rehearsal room. It's now called the Bridewell at the back of Duke Street in Liverpool. It's a bar now. And there were these disused police cells, I believe, with, you know, fittings on the wall for chains and
it's
shackles.
Very convenient.
Yeah. With, you know, heavy-duty steel doors with a little window in them. And, you know, it was a bit of a semi-derelict building. And I'd been in a couple of previous bands with these younger kids that I'd met that included Peter Gill, the drummer, and Brian Nash, and Mark O'Toole's brother, Jed O'Toole. They were like a younger generation who'd only ever been to Eric's matinees on a Saturday. Eric's would have a matinee now and again. Because everyone had been used up in previous bands like War Heat and Echo and the Bunnymen and Teardrop of Crows. Everyone I knew from the Eric scene had sort of dissipated by this point. So these younger, energetic kids were good to rehearse with. And Peter Gill left that group situation and pulled in Mark O'Toole, who I already had my eye on anyway because he was a great bass player, really fast fingers and, you know, he played better than most other people around at that time. An informal rehearsal with those two and me sort of happened, and on the first day we wrote a song called Love Has Got a Gun, which is on Welcome to the Pleasure Dome as Wish You Were Here. I didn't change the name. Some, you know, idiot producer or engineer got the name wrong on the tape box or something, but it was always Love Has Got a Gun to me.
First rehearsal as well.
First rehearsal, first song written. Yeah, just with bass drummers and vocals, that's how it was done.
Yeah.
Wait. Love is on the run. We really interviews you did at the time, and you referred to Frankie as nightlife, subculture and sexuality all rolled into one.
I suppose that's a fair description.
Yeah.
Nightlife was a big thing then for me, and at that age I was going to places like the Hacienda occasionally, or Heroes in Manchester, and going to gay clubs that played disco a lot, like Donna Summer and...
Sylvester?
Yeah, Sylvester, of course. And also the Village People, and Dancing Queen by ABBA was big. And so I was listening to dance music and sort of rock music at the same time. And frankly, I always viewed as a kind of hybrid of those two things, really. Disco and rock, which the younger members of the band were fans of. You know, people like AC/DC, I suppose, and The Cure, you know, all kinds of pop things. So it was a bit of a melting pot of musical influences, Frankie.
Yeah. You've got this incredibly strong sort of S&M image. And it seemed to take a while, looking at early reviews. People didn't really know what to make of it early on.
No, absolutely.
Which is always a good thing, I think.
It is a good thing, except that... We couldn't get arrested in the London music industry. We did demos for Polygram. We did demos for this group and this record company. And none of them were brave enough to sign us to a record deal, in actual fact. And we hung around for ages. I think we did two Peel sessions and a Kid Jensen session. But it was really appearing on the Tube... really sort of brought a lot of attention to us.
Yeah.
I think Yes were being produced by Trevor Horn at that time. And they were like, oh, come and look at this, Trevor. You know, because we had the Leather Pets with us then, which were these two girls from Kirby, the Muscatelli sisters, who look great in little mini leather dresses. And
you were done in your whatever gear, you and...
Sort of Tom of Finland, Mad Max-esque look, I suppose.
You look great. Look at those photos now. That is still a very powerful visual image.
Yeah, it was. It was a kind of post-punk, apocalyptic S&M leather look. We made our own video of it. Or Bob Johnson, our then manager... who also managed The Roots and Roddy Frame, Aztec Camera.
Right.
He sent this video around, and that's how we got the Tube.
Right.
Came to Liverpool. Jules Holland came with a film crew and filmed us performing a demo of Relax at the State Ballroom, which was a sort of Liverpool's most glamorous nightclub at the time.
But it's interesting watching that performance. There's two things. One is... the heart of the song's there. I know you could talk an awful lot about producers and what happens afterwards, but on that performance, the song's there is the first thing.
Absolutely. The main refrain...
That hammering thing is
the chorus,
there.
Which the song begins with, is there. And the middle eight is different on that performance, but the middle eight was amended by the time we got to the... Kid Jensen session, if you ever listen to that. I'm sure it's in the BBC archive.
We'll play it now.
Okay, great.
Don't do it
That had the shorter, well, Shoot It in the Right Direction middle eight, because I knew that previous middle eight was too fancy and a bit crazy for the world. So I think Trevor Horn was going home from the studio when Kid Jensen played that and decided to contact us through our then manager, Bob Johnson, or through Probe Records. I'm not quite sure how it happened and how we ended up getting signed to ZTT Records. He'd seen the tube, but then forgot about us. But later on, just as we were about to split up, we heard the Kid Jensen session. I think that clinched it.
Why hasn't Relax aged? Why is it still such a powerful track? Because it is. So much music through, I know, the context of the words of the melody just doesn't age well. Relax stands totally outside that.
Yes, well, Relax in many ways is the blueprint for modern pop music.
It was so
advanced technologically in the way it was produced then.
It's more than the technology.
There's something about the soul
of that song.
It is more.
How that song makes people... And you can look at the video and you can talk about the appeal of the seediness and all the sexuality, but...
It's also a primal male orgasm that you're hearing on the song, which hadn't been heard before.
Yeah.
We'd heard Donna Summer going, love to love you, baby. And we'd heard Je t'aime mon plus. But we hadn't really had a male ejaculating over the airwaves.
Primal is the word, though, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, yeah. It is very primal. And, you know, at that age, you're full of it, aren't you? Testosterone, etc. And that comes across in the very grooves of the record somehow. Hallelujah, you know, 40 years later, I'm still here talking about it.
I mean, also, I think Frankie as well, if you look at other gay pop stars at the time... And I'm generalising, clearly. In the mainstream, they were unthreatening. And I am generalising here. Frankie were never like that. You weren't asking for acceptance. You were just being whoever you wanted to be.
Yeah, it was in your face.
Yeah.
If you don't like it, lump it. We don't care. And it was very much like that. There was just something about Relax that hit the nail on the head. And then, of course, Two Tribes coming after that was... Like, beyond expectations, it was so fast.
Very few musicians have that moment when you are, without doubt, underlined, you're the biggest thing that there is. That's it. For that time, you are in the biggest band. You are the biggest artist. Everybody wants part of you. Everything you say, everything you do is going to be scrutinised. How did you deal with that, do you think? Do you think you cope with it well?
I wouldn't say that, no.
How did you cope with it?
I wasn't expecting it, really. The intensity of the scrutiny and the shock of people that I was a living and breathing gay person and not ashamed of the fact.
Yeah.
And I didn't expect that, you know, a journalist would have... a heart attack almost when he was told, oh, The Power of Love might be about Wolfgang, Holly's boyfriend. We're not sure. People didn't expect these ideas to happen. And I don't know. As soon as Relax hit number one, we were ferried about Europe on an aeroplane to perform every single European version of Top of the Pops. We did hundreds and thousands of interviews and photo sessions, and you just didn't have a minute to yourself. You lived and breathed Frankie Goes to Hollywood for the duration, you know, for the next 5 years. It was incredibly intense. And, you know, you have the enamel of youth in those days where they could go out all night and look okay the next day, even though they hammered it. I decided not to drink anymore and do all those other things that bands are well known for, because someone had to get up in the morning to do the interview or get on the plane or whatever. And also I had an older partner by that time who was a sensible, non-nightclubbing individual.
Steadying force.
From Germany, in fact, where Frankie were huge in Germany. Even the second album that didn't do as well here in the UK did incredibly well in Germany. Rage Hard was number one, for example, there. So I don't know how I cope with it, basically.
Yeah.
Just being young and being worked to death, I managed to survive it.
This is it, because like these days, thankfully, and this has changed in just the past 10 years, there is an idea of duty of care. There's idea that your management or your label will be going, this young person is in an unusual situation, the attention, we maybe need to take her or him out situation a bit, or like, you're only going to do two interviews today, not the 80 we've been asked to do. That exists now, and that's great.
But it didn't exist
in the 80s.
No, they just didn't care. As long as they were making money out of you, they didn't care. And, you know, that was just a fact of life of the era. Yeah, no, the music industry was a sleazy, dirty cesspit in the 80s, really, with lots of drugs and drink and the endless costumes you had to buy because you didn't want to be seen in the same thing twice on Top of the Pops. That was a real thing, you know. You had to have another outfit. So you just spent all your money on a new outfit all the time.
You mentioned there about how relaxed changed British, or changed all pop music. But yeah, there was, people talk about Welcome to the Pleasure Dome, the track or mix of that track being played in Chicago and being played in the clubs and kind of helping be one of the elements that starts to put together modern contemporary house and dance music as well.
Absolutely. There was a particular DJ, I think his name was Ron Hardy. Ron Hardy, who would just play Welcome to the Pleasure Dome in its entirety to open his set. And yeah, I know it was a highly influential track. That whole house music and what eventually became acid and techno really owe a debt to Relax, and also the whole multiple remix culture that occurred later on. I can't remember any other band doing so many remixes as Frankie Goes to Hollywood of each single track.
Riley and Co. on BBC Radio 6 Music. Mark and Gideon join forces.
Every Monday to Thursday.
Two presenters.
It's a 6 Music super team, to be fair.
Four nights.
Friday's off then. Okay.
A couple of live bands.
And loads of brilliant music too. With two mates trading records. And chatting late into the night. With live bands, archive sessions, plus the inevitable arguments. Full blown, I expect. And we'll be playing all sorts of records, new and old, business as usual.
Riley and Co. Listen Monday to Thursday night from 9, or anytime on BBC Sounds. It's Matt Everett's The First Time with Holly Johnson.
6 Music.
So on the other side of Frankie, there's this really gnarly court case, which seemed to be, apart from being labyrinthine and enormously expensive, I would imagine, enormously emotionally draining after the height of, like, this creativity, and then things change and go wrong. But then in the wake of this, when you should be relaxingly enjoying the fruits of your work, because it went on for a long time, this court case, didn't it?
It did. Basically, I just couldn't cope anymore. I couldn't cope with the relationships within the band, and I couldn't cope with the relationship with the record company. It became a very toxic atmosphere for me.
In what way?
Well, you know, I wasn't talking to the manager. The band members weren't talking to me, some of them. They were sending me legal letters during the recording of the second album.
Always good. Legal letters is always going to help creativity, isn't it?
Oh, isn't it?
Really going to help.
Isn't it? And, you know, and all these things came out in the court case. Basically, what happened, I took legal advice and they said, well, really, this contract you've signed was unenforceable. Because it's so restrictive to you, it's ridiculous. And it finally got to court in 1988, I believe, yeah. And that was a two-week torture of every day turning up in court and being basically slagged off by ZTT's barrister and various members of ZTT Record Company. And the press were lapping it up. Because they wanted to, you know, drag down this kid from Liverpool who, of course, they thought had got too big for his boots. And then we presented our evidence and bizarrely, I thought at the time, I won the case. Even though the contract stood as it was deemed in restraint of trade. That's the legal term.
Yeah.
And I was the first artist to get out of a recording or film contract and creating a legal precedent.
Okay.
That was later used by people like George Michael and the Stone yeah. Roses and legal affairs teams in the music industry had to change contracts with other bands because of this landmark decision.
That's quite a nice legacy in some
way. It is. A nice legacy.
For someone else, not necessarily for you at the time.
Yeah, I mean, I remember one of the Pogues thanking me for going through with it all. But it didn't do me any favours within the music industry itself. But I'd had to borrow the money from MCA to go through the court case. So I sort of went out of the frying pan into the fire.
But Blast comes out.
Yes.
Your first seller record. And then, I mean, there is nothing better than what's the best revenge is success, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. It was number one the first week it was released in 1989. And I did feel vindicated to a degree, you know, because ZTT had claimed during the court case that I was a bad singer who they'd had to, you know, tart up in the studio and... Yeah, I did feel vindicated to a certain degree. And it was great to have a number one album as a solo artist. It was great for a while.
This place where a kid without a cent can grow up to be president.
To be president.
Magic kingdom filled with Barbie dolls. If you got the time, we can
kings and heroes in the land of the free. You can be what you wanna be.
Tell me about the Eurovision reunion. Because the rumour is, right, that it was like, oh, they're going to come on, they're going to do loads of songs, da-da-da. And it was like, no, one song, that's all you're getting, big explosion, and off we pop again. It felt like quite a stylish way of doing it.
Well, that's an interesting take on it. The fact is, I was busy preparing my tour that I've just finished, which is Holly Says Relax, 40th anniversary of Relax, and 35-year anniversary of Blast. And out of the blue came these bizarre requests from the BBC. Hundreds of emails went back and forward. And I said, well, I'd do it because it's a great thing for Liverpool. But then the BBC or the production company had all these stipulations. No, you can't do Two Tribes. No, you can't do Relax. You can only do Welcome to the Pleasure Dome. It's an opening ceremony. It can't be completely live. Only the vocals can be live. But we would prefer, you know, if you mimed. And I was like, oh, my God. And certain members of the band didn't want to do it, and some did. And there was so many people involved. And I thought, oh, here we go again. You know, here we go again. But somehow it did come together. It did happen.
And people loved it.
Yeah, people loved it. But there was a lot of disappointment that we didn't do lots of songs.
Yeah.
Especially amongst the home crowd in Liverpool. And yet other bands got to do two songs on the programme. We couldn't understand that. But we did it. It was a very positive experience. We all got on with each other after so long. And I'm really glad it happened. Liverpool embraced it incredibly well. Mm-hmm. It was just a brilliant thing for Liverpool, Ukraine and everyone else, really. So
when bands get back together, you can do it properly. The production is better, the staging, the PAs, the whole thing can be done in a way that maybe you couldn't do before, and you can do that. You can do the proper show. Has that opened the door on the idea of doing that? Because you could do the arenas, you could do it as a group again.
It has opened people's minds to that possibility. But as I said, not all the members of Frankie Goes to Hollywood are on board with that concept. And we haven't had a sufficient offer from promoters that would make it worthwhile for us to do. It would take a lot of rehearsal. Some of the members of the band haven't played their instruments for quite some time.
Can't go out and be rubbish. It's got to be good.
No, of course. And the fact that we all live in different countries, you know, New Zealand, Florida, and three of us here in the UK, that's a bit of an obstacle, obviously. But if the right offer came along, and I think people would be open to it in the group, I'd certainly talk about it. But I'm very, very happy touring on my own and performing at festivals in the summer on my own as Holly Johnson. So if it doesn't happen, I won't lose any sleep over it. I'm at a good point in my life at the moment.
Should I put my weapons down? Turn and walk away, don't look around. They want me to say my lessons learned. Didn't think I'd find so much strength in the hurt. So I push away that feeling. There's no truth in what they're saying. Never giving, only taking. From this I'm escaping ascension. Just got holding me. Oh, to rise like an angel. Just to kiss every star. See the clouds silver lining. flying high and far. Oh, ascension, that's what I want. Take me to that hallowed ground, high above, so safe and sound. Do your best to clip my wings. You see, my skin is thicker than you think.
Final question. What's the last song we should play? What should we go out on?
Well, I always think it should end with The Power of Love.
I'm not going to argue with you, mate. It's a beautiful way to end a show. It's been a pleasure speaking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Matt.
I'll protect you from the hooded claw. Keep the vampires from your door. Feels like fire. I'm so in love with you. Dreams are like angels. They keep bad at bay, bad at bay. Love is the light, scaring darkness away. Yeah. I'm so in love with you. Purge the soul. Make love your goal. The power of love, a force from above, cleaning my soul. Flame. Down, I'll be around with my undying, death-defying love for you. Envy will hurt itself. Let yourself be beautiful, sparkling love, flowers and pearls and pretty girls. Love is like an energy.
this time we go sublime. Lovers entwined, divine, divine. Love is danger, love is pleasure. Love is pure, the only treasure.
That was, of course, Frankie Goes to Hollywood's classic 1984 number one single, The Power of Love, Not Just for Christmas. Featuring words and vocals, courtesy of my guest on The First Time this week, Holly Johnson. We'll be back tomorrow with a brand new episode of The First Time, where my guest will be Kate Le Bon. And of course, you can listen back to previous First Time shows from the archive, including my conversations with Janelle Monáe, Tom York, Chris Cornell, Dr. John and Liam Gallagher. That's all up on BBC Sounds. Until next time, I've been Matt Everett. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, sir. Frankie C, no more.
This is BBC
Radio 6
Music.